Good day. Today is Monday, 11th May 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, before I proceed with the main topics of my programme today, which are the conflict in Ukraine and the conflict in the Persian Gulf, let me very quickly say something about the situation in Britain. Over the weekend, as often happens in Britain, there's been considerable debate, discussion, plotting, scheming, all of those things within the British Labour Party and within the general political system about the future of Britain's current Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer. Now, Prime Minister Starmer is, of course, aware of all of this plotting. He's made it very clear that he wants to remain Prime Minister. And today he was to deliver a speech which was to explain why he thinks that he is the right man to remain Prime Minister and to guide Britain through its many deep-seated and increasingly critical problems. And of course, he did this against a backdrop of more and more members of the Labour Party, members of the Labour Party's parliamentary faction, coming out increasingly strongly and saying that Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, should either resign immediately or set a timetable for himself to do so. So it was seen, this speech was seen by many people as a make or break moment. Well, entirely predictably, Keir Starmer made his speech, and entirely predictably, it turned out to be empty, vacuous, barren of ideas and content, as stilted and as unconvincing as we would expect from this Prime Minister. There was absolutely nothing in this speech which would persuade anybody with any serious concerns about the future of Britain that this is indeed the man who should be guiding Britain through its various problems at this time. And entirely predictably, again, after this astonishingly vacuous, anticlimactic speech that Prime Minister Starmer delivered, to get a sense of how empty of content it was, as well as telling us an awful lot about his beliefs and values, which is already a challenging thing for him to talk about, to put it mildly, given that many people feel that he doesn't have much of either. Anyway, on top of that, he announced three policy initiatives, except that they had nothing to do with the issues, the concerns that worry people at this current time about the cost of living, higher taxes, the sagging condition of the economy, immigration, war or peace or any of these things. Instead, he said that he wanted to nationalise the British Steel Company, which most people believed was already in public ownership. Secondly, at a time when the anti-EU Reform UK party is massively in the ascendant, he said that he wanted to take Britain deeper into Europe. Of course, that is what many people in Britain suspect and already, if you wish, fear about him. So he confirmed that those suspicions are true. And third, most incredible of all, he said that he would conduct a further crackdown on agitation by what he referred to as the far right which again is an issue entirely remote from the concerns of most people in Britain. Anyway, after this extraordinarily empty and vacuous speech, well, the plotting and the demands that Starmer stepped down seem to have intensified. I am now starting to think that we have indeed finally reached the end point with this Prime Minister. One can never be completely sure. With the Labour Party, it is impossible to make those kind of assumptions. But after today's abject performance, I would have thought so. It may be, and I accept this, that this is the wish on my part, being the father to the thought, of my wanting to see Starmer go. I consider him to be the worst and most disastrous Prime Minister of my lifetime, even worse than Liz Truss, just saying. But, well, I do on balance think so. I think that most people across Britain, I think many people now within the political class, share my own feeling, which is summed up by an American poem of the 19th century. Yesterday, upon the stair, I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish he'd go away. Anyway, that's where I'm going to leave this topic, with apologies to anybody outside Britain who is less interested in it. If within the next few hours or days, Keir Starmer is indeed gone, then obviously I will return to the topic and decide and discuss what exactly comes next. Well, let us now turn to the more perhaps serious, more pressing problems of the hour, and let's start with the situation in Ukraine, because today the ceasefire that Putin and ultimately Trump announced and agreed to cover the Victory Day holiday, today the ceasefire ends. And the indications are that we are indeed going to get a renewed Russian offensive. And we can tell where the major focal points of this offensive are going to be. Firstly, they will be in Konstantinovka, the town that the Russians are storming, at the southern end of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk-Konstantinovka conurbation. The Russians now control, according to Stanislav Krapivnik, around half of it, and the Ukrainian troops within Konstantinovka have been leafleted by the Russians, telling them to either surrender or withdraw. They are already practically in a cauldron and will certainly become so, or so it seems to me, if they are given orders to stand and fight. So that will be one area where the Russians will focus and renew their offensive. The other is in the area north of Slavyansk, at the other end of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk-Konstantinovka conurbation. The Russians are in the process of storming the town of Liman, of capturing to the east of Kramatorsk the village of Raya Alexandrovka, which is located on a hill, of enlarging control in the large forested area to the north of Slavyansk, the area which back in 2022 the Russian military used to call Sherwood Forest. The Russians also have now concentrated a very powerful force in southwestern Zaporozhye region, south of the city of Zaporozhye, supposedly five airborne divisions, paratroop divisions, And according to the Ukrainians, there are now long columns of Russian infantry and armoured vehicles moving in this direction. The Ukrainians attempted over the last 2 weeks to carry out their own offensive in this area, presumably in order to disrupt the Russian plans. There's been much talk about whether the Ukrainians have had any success, whether they've captured or recaptured some parts of the village of Primorske, or perhaps even all of the village, whether they've reached the town of Stepnogorsk that the Russians captured a few weeks ago. For the record, I think that, as is always the case with these Ukrainian offensives, we will discover soon enough that these Ukrainian advances in these areas, if they have taken place at all, have been ephemeral and have involved heavy losses and will have only weakened Ukrainian ability to conduct defence south of the city of Zaporozhye. But anyway, there's high expectations that the Russians will resume their offensive in that area now that they have completed their major reorganisation. And there is also reports that the Russians are going to renew their offensive towards the town of Orekhov from eastern Zaporozhye as well. There were reports just before the Victory Day holiday that the Russians have penetrated the last defence lines around Orekhov and that they are on the brink of attacking Orekhov from the northeast, from in effect encircling the town and the Ukrainian garrison there. And of course, if Orekhov is captured, not only will that be the last important town in Zaporozhye region, other than the city of Zaporozhye itself, that remains under Ukrainian control, which the Russians will have captured. But the fall of Orekhov will unite the two Russian groups of forces in operating in Zaporozhye region and will bring a very powerful Russian force indeed to the outskirts of the city of Zaporozhye, positioned to cut Ukrainian positions, to cut off Ukrainian positions on the east bank of the Dnieper in central Ukraine. So that's another big battle that is likely coming. And, well, several people, Stanislav Krapivnik, who we've just interviewed on the Duran, you can find the interview on the Duran now. Some believe that there's also going to be a major Russian operation in the north around the city of Sumy, though I personally believe that that is more likely to take place later in the summer, maybe after the battles of Donbass and Orekhov have concluded. So anyway, this is the expectation now, that the Russian offensive will restart with renewed force and the Ukrainians in a much weaker position to withstand it than they have been at any time in the war up to now, at any point since they themselves were conducting their offensive in Zaporozhye region, trying unsuccessfully to break through to the Black Sea in the summer of 2023. So that's where we are on the military fronts. And, well, I've also discussed in many places, many programmes, the fact that, in my opinion, this is going to be the year when the Russians will successfully neutralise the problem of Russian drones, both strategic drones launched into Russia with the help of the Europeans and the Americans, and the tactical first-person view FPV drones that have been used by the Ukrainians so heavily to try to hold on to their positions on the front lines. And in relation to drones, drone use, here I've had some rather interesting information, because over the last few weeks, the last 2 weeks, the Russians delivered a series of very strong warnings to the Baltic states, to the three Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania and Estonia, and to Finland, about the fact that Ukrainian drones were conducting attacks in northwestern Russia, transiting through the airspace of these four countries. And it's very interesting, because the governments of all of these countries and the European Union basically were silent after these initial Russian warnings. And then video footage began to appear, which did indeed show drones, Ukrainian drones, what were identified and universally acknowledged to be Ukrainian drones, transiting towards Russia through the airspace of some of these countries. Finland then strongly protested to Ukraine about this practice. Apparently Lithuania also did so, though I am not absolutely sure about this. However, the defense minister of Latvia, even whilst admitting that Ukrainian drones were indeed conducting strikes inside Russia by transiting over Ukrainian Latvian airspace, basically said that Latvia would do nothing about it, that intercepting the drones would be dangerous, because if the drones fell, they might cause damage or injury to Latvian people on the ground. And besides, ultimately, it was all Russia's fault anyway. That is what he said. Well, at around the same time as he was saying it, pictures appeared of a Ukrainian drone attacking, very mysteriously, an oil facility in Latvia itself. And I speculated, after I saw the footage of that happen, that perhaps there had been some mistake, or maybe the Ukrainians intentionally attacked this oil storage facility because they'd learned that there was Russian oil stored there. I said that, to my knowledge, and I repeat this, by the way, despite all of the denials and claims to the contrary, some Russian oil does indeed still trade through the Baltic states. Anyway, I speculated about all of these things, but then I received, again, information from a source. That's all I can say about him, but a very, very reliable source, who told me what I am certain is the truth. And that is that, in fact, what happened was that the Russians have managed to hack into the Starlink system that guides these drones, something which the US assumed was impossible, and that they managed to take control of these drones. And in order to demonstrate to the Latvians and to the others how dangerous it is for them to allow drones from Ukraine to cross their airspace on their way to Russia, the Russians, having hacked the drones, having hacked the Starlink system, then guided these Ukrainian drones to attack energy facilities inside Latvia. And, well, this has created apparently something of a stir and a panic in Latvia. I should say that I'm confident that this information is correct. And the result is that the Latvians have now sacked the Latvian defense minister, who seemed so intensely relaxed about the movement of Ukrainian drones across Latvia's airspace. So they've sacked him. Now, I'm going to suggest that those Russian warnings of about 2 weeks ago about Russia taking action to stop the movement of Ukrainian drones over the airspace of the Baltic countries, that those warnings and those threats were made with the specific knowledge which the Russians already had, that they had, that they would be able to hack the Starlink system and to gain control of these drones and to redirect them onto targets within these countries. So the Russians knew that they had obtained this capability, and it was this that encouraged them to give the warnings that they did. And we see that it is having an effect, and that for the moment at least, the three Baltic countries and the Finns look like they're going to, at least for a time, disallow the use of their airspace by Ukraine for its drones to attack targets inside Russia. Now, whether this will hold for very long will depend on that ceaseless battle that takes place between the engineers, the Russian engineers, who have repeatedly shown their abilities first to jam and then to hack the Starlink system. We saw that work during the Iranian protests in January, when the Russians, and I've no doubt now it was the Russians, successfully helped the Iranians to jam Starlink transmissions to the protesters. So there is that, there's what the Russians do, and then there's of course the counteraction taken by Starlink engineers, undoubtedly backed by the resources of the Pentagon, trying to find some way to regain control of the Starlink system to defeat Russian jamming and hacking. This struggle, this conflict goes on all the time. I doubt that either side can gain a permanent ascendancy, but the Russians do, it seems, have the capabilities to jam and to hack the Starlink system from time to time, and perhaps increasingly for extended periods of time. Anyway, there it is. So this is what has happened, and it has had an effect. Now, much, no doubt, will also play out over the next few weeks in the war. But the critical battle continues to be Donbass. That is where the bulk of the Ukrainian forces are. That is where, by the way, the bulk of the Russian forces are. Donbass is the major fortified region that the Ukrainians have. And of course, the Russians have now reached the last line of defense. Now, Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Ushakov, has been talking again about the situation. And he has talked about the situation in the diplomatic field. And he has again suggested that the diplomacy between the United States, Russia and Ukraine is, to all in purposes, now at an end. And Ushakov was speaking on Russian television to Pavel Zarubin, Putin's favourite journalist, and this is what Ushakov is reported by TASS to have said. Until Ukraine takes this step, and he's withdrawing to a withdrawal from some region, we can hold several more rounds, dozens of rounds of talks, but we will remain in exactly the same place. And everyone understands this in Kiev too. But for now, with the support of the Europeans, they refuse to take the reasonable step. They refuse even to begin discussing this step. They know in Ukraine that this must be done and that sooner or later they will do it anyway, but for the moment they are not doing it. So what is this step that Ushakov is talking about without which no negotiations can take place, without which negotiations of any kind are irrelevant? Well, TASS, in reporting Ushakov's words, say that it is for the Ukrainians to withdraw from Donbass, to be precise, from Donetsk region. And again, most sites, most commentators who are reporting Ushakov's words assume that this report from TASS is true, and that the step that Ushakov is referring to is indeed a withdrawal by Ukraine from Donbass. Now, my one concern here is that, again, Ushakov's actual words, as reported by TASS, do not refer to Donbass or Donetsk. They only refer to this reasonable step that Ukraine must take, and the one which it knows all about, but which it refuses to take, and which it is backed by the Europeans in not taking. Now, that may very well be a withdrawal from Donetsk. And if I may say, I think it probably is. My one major reason for concern here is because, as I discussed at length in my program yesterday, TASS was reporting over the last 2 days that at a press conference that Putin gave on Saturday, after the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow, Putin said that he believed that the conflict in Ukraine was approaching its end. As I explained carefully in yesterday's program and in a post that I published on X, when you actually go to Putin's words, that was not what he said at all. So it may be that once again TASS is jumping to the wrong conclusions, is assuming that Ushakov merely means Donetsk, when he might be meaning something else, something like a withdrawal from Donetsk, obviously, but from Zaporozhye and Kherson regions as well. For the record, I think most likely Ushakov did mention Donetsk, and that was indeed what he meant, but I have to make that caveat because I don't definitely know. And as I said, the words of his, which Tass is quoting, fall short of that. Now, in relation to this, as Ushakov correctly says, the Ukrainians are completely rejecting any idea of a withdrawal from Donetsk. This is despite the fact that now there are increasing numbers of commentaries about the fact that in Donetsk, this line of fortified towns, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinivka, Druzhivka, are now essentially in a bag and are very close to being surrounded. In fact, I recently saw a map which shows where the Russians are. And you can see that they are to the south and east and north of all of these towns. The only area where the Russians are not present yet is to the west of these towns. The Russians, in other words, have this whole group of towns now in a semicircle. And by the way, they're very close to capturing all the high ground around these towns. It is only in the west where there are still roads that lead into Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. It is only in the west where the Russians have not yet established a strong presence. But Russian forces are located in places north of Pokrovsk, close to the town of Dobropilia, which would put them to the southwest of this line of fortified towns. And it is, I would say, a certainty that it, even as the Russians press on all three of these towns, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinivka, and Druzhivka too, press on all these towns on the north, south, and east, they will increasingly do so from the west as well. With Pokrovsk and Mirnograd now under Russian control, with Rodinska and Belitskaya, in the case of Rodinska, definitely. In the case of Belitskaya, probably under Russian control too, with the Russians soon to capture Konstantinivka. The effective encirclement of this line of towns is, well, now a certainty. And if the Russians capture Liman and other places, Sviatogorsk and the Sherwood Forest region north of Slavyansk, well, they would be in a position where their drone operators would be able, with fiber optic drones, also to close all the supply routes into these towns from the northwest. Again, in effect, placing the entire territory in Donetsk in a cauldron. So Zelensky and his military chiefs, Sirsky and Gnatov. Gnatov is the chief of staff. Sirsky is the overall commander. Presumably know this. But all of the indications are that they're not prepared to withdraw from these towns. They intend to hold them to the bitter end. They're certainly not prepared to give up claims to them. And, well, that sets us up for an enormous battle in Donbass and the entrapment and collapse of an important percentage of Ukraine's army, just saying. But it also means that we are very unlikely to see any peace agreement, any movement in negotiations from this point on. Because the key thing that Ushakov is saying is that negotiations are at a standstill because Ukraine is refusing to even reach first base. And in light of that, there is no point in continuing with negotiations further, which means that negotiations essentially are dead. And that, of course, brings us to the next question. What does happen when there is the encirclement of all of these towns? What happens when there is a collapse in these towns? Well, I'm going to guess, firstly, we will initially get the standard pattern from the Ukrainians of denial that this is happening at all. They will insist that the towns are not surrounded, that the positions are still holding, that Konstantinovka is not under Russian control, that the forest north of Slavyansk is not under Russian control, that Rai Alexandrovka are not under Russian control. And when the Russians enter these towns, they will deny that this is happening. And then when those denials become impossible, they will say that these are only small groups of infiltrators, and it doesn't really mean that the towns themselves are at any imminent risk of falling. And there will be denials that there is encirclement, and there will be denials that the troops are short of supplies or anything of that kind. And as we recently saw in Kupiansk, if pictures emerge of emaciated soldiers because there are no supplies, well, that will be blamed on the local commanders, not on strategic decisions made by the trinity of Zelensky, Sirsky and Gnatov. So we're going to get all of that. But one thing we are not going to get, I am confident, is any kind of retreat. And if the towns are indeed encircled, well, we will see eventually a mood of crisis take hold, and the Ukrainians will at that point finally turn to their European friends and will plead and beg them to intervene so that they can continue to hold these positions in Donbass. And they will plead to the French, to Macron, who has been agitating to send French troops to Ukraine ever since the fall of Avdiivka in early 2024. And they will turn to the British, irrespective of whether Starmer is Prime Minister or not, and of who replaces Starmer. Whoever replaces Starmer in Britain is going to be as committed to Project Ukraine as Starmer himself is. And, of course, they will be pleading with the Germans, where they'll be pleading with Friedrich Merz, assuming Merz is still Chancellor, and they will be pleading with Germany's Defence Minister, Boris Pistorius, who is now in Kiev. And we're not being provided with much information about the exact reasons and purposes of Pistorius's visit. But I am going to make a suggestion that probably, despite all of the talk and bragging and claims about Ukraine holding its positions in Donbass, Pistorius is going to Ukraine. He's, by the way, an arch hawk. He's a strong supporter of Ukraine. Anyway, I suspect that Pistorius is there to talk to the Ukrainians in part in order to get their assurance that the lines in Donbass are still holding. Why he would believe that assurance when it is given, I have no idea. But there's been an endless succession of American and European visitors who've gone to Kiev and received these assurances. I remember Biden's defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, going to Kiev and getting assurances of exactly that kind in the past, as well as demands from the Ukrainians for more weapons than the United States actually had. But anyway, Pistorius will undoubtedly receive these assurances, but the Ukrainians will also press him, as they always do, for more money, more weapons deliveries, more aid, more open-ended aid for Ukraine, because for Zelensky and his officials, that now is the single most important thing. And that is what brings me to the next part of this discussion, because events in Ukraine, that invaluable blog has been going through the Mindich tapes, and we've been provided with, on that blog, with extensive transcripts of the discussions that have been taking place between Mindich, the probable, likely owner of Firepoint, the Ukrainian arms company, the man at the centre of the Golden Toilets scandal that burst into view in Ukraine last summer. Anyway, Mindich, who's now in Israel, has been in regular contact, both before going to Israel and since, with top officials in Ukraine. Top officials, I should make it clear, of Zelensky's government. Most of these tapes appeared to involve discussions between Mindich and Rustem Umerov, an ally of Zelensky's, previously Ukraine's defense minister, now secretary of Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, Ukraine's erstwhile chief negotiator in the now indefinitely suspended talks between the Ukrainians, the Russians, and the Americans, a man who at the peak point of the Mindich scandal in the summer left Ukraine. There was a lot of speculation that Umerov would never be coming back, that he might be going to the United States. He ended up in Florida, where he had meetings with the FBI, perhaps looking for protection, and with Witkoff, just saying. He did eventually come back to Ukraine, and he's still active. But these tapes, again, demonstrate how deeply implicated in this scandal Umerov is. And, well, via Umerov, no doubt, ultimately, Zelensky himself. And, well, there's a number of interesting conclusions that can be drawn from these tapes. Firstly, and this is just an aside, but it's one that has been noticed in Ukraine, all of these individuals, Umerov, Mindich, all of the others, the people who were involved in the corruption scandal, who were arranging for all of these contracts to be given to Firepoint, these people, these Ukrainian patriots and nationalists who are committed to this struggle against Russia. Well, the language they all talk in with each other, it turns out, isn't Ukrainian at all. It's actually Russian. It's a very coarse Russian, littered apparently with the usual bad language, but it is nonetheless Russian. That continues to be the favoured language that they all use with each other. But perhaps more importantly, what comes across is the extent to which that which my friend and colleague Alex Christoforou has always been saying, that Ukraine is first and foremost a grift, the extent to which this is ultimately true. Because it's very obvious when you read these tapes, the transcripts provided by these tapes, and even more obvious when you read the commentary provided by the blogger known as Events in Ukraine, that for Umerov and Mindich and people like that, the most important fact about the war, the thing that makes the continuation of the war indefinitely so attractive, is that it is for them a colossal money spinner. Money comes in from the West. It's supposed to be used to make weapons. Firepoint is the company that gets the contracts to make the weapons. As I said, it's extraordinary that this company still gets puff pieces in places like the London Times. But anyway, it gets the contracts. It's supposed to produce weapons like the Flamingo missile, which has been notable for its absence, just saying. It is involved undoubtedly in drone manufacturing, and there it must be said that it has actually produced quite a lot of hardware, though how effective it's been is another question. But anyway, from the perspective of Mindich and Umerov and of all of these people, this is a flow of money that is making them all very rich, and which they clearly don't have any wish or desire to stop. So let us assume that the Russians do surround the Ukrainian troops in Donbass. Let us assume that the Ukrainians do indeed go to the Europeans and beg the Europeans to intervene to help them and save them in Donbass. Let's assume that the Europeans don't intervene, and in reality, there is no realistic possibility that they will. Without the United States, they absolutely lack the military capabilities to take on the Russians. And, well, in Europe, there is no widespread support for this. And in fact, it would be massively and extremely and dangerously unpopular for any of the political leaders involved. So let's assume that it all goes terribly wrong. Donbass falls, large numbers of Ukrainian soldiers are killed or taken prisoner. The Europeans do nothing. Well, the calculus that Mindich, Umerov, Zelensky, and all of the others, and there are many others, by the way. If you go to Events in Ukraine, you will see how many others there are. Well, from their point of view, the rationale of keeping the war going in order to keep the money flow will remain. And what Ushakov is talking about the Ukrainians taking the first step, or steps towards securing peace, that is not going to happen. It simply will not take place. I have long been of the view that there is no circumstance or set of situations which would persuade Zelensky to make peace with Russia now. He might have been prepared to do it back in March, April 2022, when the Istanbul Agreement was negotiated and initialed and appeared to receive Zelensky's private, a public backing. But that was then. Today, it's absolutely not happening. The war will go on and no negotiations will take place. And I'm going to here express my belief. I think Putin knows this perfectly well. I think Ushakov knows this perfectly well. I think that they have no belief or expectation or ultimately even desire for an outcome, a negotiated outcome to this war. And they know Zelensky and they know that it will never be done. There's been a great deal of speculation about why the Russians do not come for Zelensky himself, why they leave him alive and in control in Kiev. Well, I am going to suggest that from a Russian point of view, assuming that their objectives extend beyond Donbass and perhaps beyond Zaporozhye and Kherson and extend all the way to Odessa and Kharkiv and potentially even Kiev itself, or go beyond that. Well, from a Russian perspective, if that is the Russian goals, then it absolutely suits them to keep Zelensky alive and to leave him in control. Because by doing so, the Russians in effect ensure that there will be no negotiated resolution to the war, and the war will be determined on the battlefield, which is what the hardliners in Moscow actually want. Well, in the meantime, the Russians have said that they do not expect that Zelensky is going to be overthrown. And again, this comes from Vladimir Zharykin, Deputy Director of the Institute of the Commonwealth of Independent States. He said these things in an interview to the TASS news agency. The Minditch tapes cannot provoke a crisis that would remove Zelensky. A political crisis alone won't be enough to oust Zelensky. Only a coup d'etat, an actual coup, can do this. And then Zharykin continues, regrettably, there isn't a strong desire on the part of the United States to see Zelensky removed. He is currently subject to a difficult, delicate balance of criticism and praise. With these audio tapes, that is to say the Minditch tapes, serving as mild blackmail, but no decisive action is being taken. So, according to Zharykin, and I am sure that he represents the consensus Russian position, and by the way, I'm also sure he is right. The Minditch tapes are interesting in themselves. They tell us a lot about how Ukraine works and the corruption at the centre of everything. They tell us a little about the kind of external pressures that Zelensky from time to time comes under. But ultimately, they cannot lead to the collapse of his regime. For that to happen, there would have to be a decision, not just by the Americans, but by the Europeans as well, obliging Zelensky to step down. And for the moment, that isn't happening. And I'm going to suggest that that will continue to be so once Donbass is lost, because the Europeans also want to prolong the war. There's articles now in the Financial Times and in other places which say it. The rationale today is that the war must be prolonged in order to give Europe time to rearm and reorganize, even though Europe is not rearming and it is not reorganizing. These are rationalizations rather than reasons. And by the way, they are deeply immoral and cynical in themselves. But the Europeans know, just as the Russians do, just as the Americans do, that so long as Vladimir Zelensky remains in place, the war is going to continue. There will be no negotiated resolution. And since, for entirely different reasons, like the Russians, the Europeans also want the war to continue, they will do everything within their power to ensure that Zelensky does indeed remain in place. And in light of that, I think Zhurikin is right. I don't expect that Zelensky will fall. It would need indeed a coup d'etat to remove him, and there is no sign that that coup d'etat for the moment is going to happen. So there we are. And I think this is the situation that suits the Russians absolutely fine. Now, in the meantime, the Russians, following on from that press conference of Putin's, have clearly mostly given up on Europe. Putin did meet with Robert Fico of Slovakia. Russia will continue to the extent that it can to support someone like Fico. And they will also maintain their support to the extent that they can provide support to Serbia, which is another European country, one of the few that remains friendly and aligned to themselves. But despite the various claims that you see from time to time about a rethinking supposedly taking place in Europe, my own sense for the moment is that barring a political crisis which would have to take place in Germany, the European elite, the European Commission, the NATO Secretariat, the government in Berlin, Paris, London, Rome, they remain committed to this war indefinitely. Northern Europe, Northeast Europe, Scandinavia, the Baltic states, Poland, remain committed to the war as well. When Vladimir Putin was asked 2 days ago who he would accept as a European representative to conduct negotiations with himself, when he replied Gerhard Schröder, what he really meant was no one. Again, it's strange that people don't understand the meaning of Putin's words. Putin does not believe that there's going to be any diplomatic initiative to end this war from the Europeans. As I discussed in my program yesterday, he is furious and very bitter about the Europeans. He does not expect anything good from his point of view to come from them. And he does not expect economic links between Russia and Europe to be restored anytime soon. He is heading east to China, probably within the next 2 or 3 weeks. And there are reports circulating in Moscow that an enormous deal with China is about to be done. And almost certainly, it will be first and foremost a deal about energy. The crisis in the Persian Gulf has, I think, now confirmed the belief in Beijing that the United States is indeed looking for ways to cut off China from oil, to enforce an economic blockade on China at some point in the future. Well, that might not be the exact American plan, but the key thing is that the Chinese now believe that there is a good chance that it is. So, given that this is so, even allowing for the fact that up to now, China has successfully managed to ride out the problems caused by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the Chinese have every incentive to deepen their economic links with the Russians, because they know that it is the Russians, first and foremost, that can provide them with the oil, the gas, the grain, the food, the minerals, all of these things that China needs in order to keep the wheels of its mighty economy turning. And I noticed that in the first 4 months of this year, the months, in other words, which correspond with the start of this crisis in the Persian Gulf, economic relations, trade between China and Russia has increased in volume terms as compared to last year by a fifth, which is a huge surge. And for the record, Russia is one of the few countries that I know of, and certainly it is the only major developed country that I know of, that actually runs a trade surplus with China. So anyway, we're likely to see even more of that. And whatever the objectives, whatever the purposes of the Persian Gulf War, of the attack on Iran, whether it really is, as virtually everybody assumes, I assume, was at least in part intended to cut off energy supplies from Iran to China and to cause problems for China in that way. The real effect of this war, as far as China is concerned, is that they have the reserves to ride out the crisis, the current crisis. However, their long-term solution is to deepen their relations with Russia. And that is, of course, exactly what they're going to do. I spoke recently about the Chinese decision, the Chinese government's decision to order Chinese oil refiners to import oil from wherever it comes and to ignore any sanctions or secondary sanctions that the United States might have imposed on that oil. Obviously, that relates to Iranian oil, but the oil that the Chinese, far-sighted people as they are, will be most focused on will be the oil from Russia, because that is the oil and the gas that is going to be coming to China over the next few years in hugely increased volumes. And, well, I discussed yesterday Putin's very bitter words about the Europeans, and obviously he no longer expects relations, economic relations between the Europeans and the Russians to be restored. He's going to move forward with these enormous deals with the Chinese. One way or the other, and I'm not sure that this is well understood in Germany or in the rest of Europe now, the option of one day re-establishing the energy relationship with Russia, for Europe, that option is closing. Putin is going to sign off on other enormous deals with China, probably in the next few weeks, probably this month, or perhaps next month. Once the infrastructure is built, once the pipelines are built, and these two countries build pipelines fast, and pumping stations and refining stations and all of the things that go with them, once all that is done, the energy will be flowing eastwards. It will no longer be flowing west. Now, I don't think anything can change this. Macron has spent a large amount of time in Yerevan talking to Pashinyan, who's facing an election in Armenia, an election next month. Pashinyan has shaved his beard for some strange reason ahead of that election. Macron has been backing him and has been talking grandly about the importance of events in the Caucasus. It does seem very strange to me that the leader of France, one of the leading European countries, is focusing on Armenia, a small country in the Caucasus, undefendable by NATO, with a small economy worth, I believe, its GDP is about $29 billion or so, I understand. They're worrying about that, even as this gigantic recalibration between the Chinese and the Russians, which has such enormous implications for Europe, is underway. It demonstrates again the extraordinary lack of contact with reality that has become such a feature in Europe today. Well, anyway, that now brings me to the situation in the Persian Gulf. And there's been an extraordinary article by the Pope of the American neocons, Robert Kagan, the man who, more than anyone else, has advocated neocon policies and neocon positions, who's been a major advocate of every single neocon war up to now, who agitated constantly and incessantly for an attack on Iran, just saying, who has been a fervid supporter of Project Ukraine and for the conflict with Russia, whose wife is none other than Victoria Nuland. Anyway, Robert Kagan has now published an extraordinary article. I did find it extraordinary. In The Atlantic, one of the most fervid neocon magazines that you can find in the United States, and an important magazine because it is also considered very much a part of the mainstream media. And the remarkable thing is that Kagan says in this article that the war in Iran has been a failure, that it has been checkmate, that it has been a disaster, that the United States is now finding itself in an intractable position, that it is proving impossible for the United States to prevail over Iran, that the Iranians are likely, after the end of this conflict, to retain control of the Strait of Hormuz, and in one form or another, are also likely to come out of this conflict stronger, that this is a much bigger geopolitical defeat for the United States than, say, Vietnam or Afghanistan were, and that after this defeat, well, the world will have changed. Now, it's very strange to be reading an article by Robert Kagan and to seeing Robert Kagan, of all people, echo back to me my own analysis. It is, of course, the analysis that we have been making on the Duran since before the conflict with Iran started. We on the Duran pointed out that the entire strategy appeared to be based on the assumption that the United States would be able to achieve regime change in Iran and achieve it quickly, that unless regime change in Iran was indeed achieved quickly, then the balance would shift in Iran's favour, that over time the United States might become bogged down in a war of attrition that it is ill-adapted to pursue. Kagan, in this article, expresses dismay that a few short weeks of conflict with Iran have run down so completely American weapons inventories with no easy way of rebuilding them. Well, Kagan says all of this. He talks about the geopolitical implications of the disaster that is now playing out in the Persian Gulf. He's doing so accurately and correctly. The big difference between him and us on the Duran, and not just us on the Duran, others too, plenty of others, Arnold Bertrand, Douglas MacGregor, Daniel Davis, these are military people, Joe Kent, just saying, Jim Webb, all of these people, geopolitical analysts as well, John Mearsheimer, Jeffrey Sachs. The difference between all of us now and Robert Kagan is that we all pointed this out before the attack on Iran took place. He is now pointing it out after it happened. We, all of us, argued against this attack on Iran because we thought what Robert Kagan is now saying would happen. Robert Kagan, who is now saying all of these things, on the contrary, was one of the advocates, along with all of the other neocons, of this attack on Iran. It would be, well, nice at some point to see neocons admitting error and coming forward and saying that what they advocated was wrong and has ended up in disaster. But, well, I never found any admission of error, any admission of responsibility for this disaster from Robert Kagan anywhere in this article in The Atlantic. Just saying. Now, I mention all of this because of something else. Because Robert Kagan, even as he admits that the war has turned out to be a complete disaster up to this point, and, by the way, a continuing disaster with the underlying crisis in the energy markets, which is gradually getting worse, just saying. Anyway, but he does, in his own way, appear to offer Donald Trump a way out, which is to escalate the war. He doesn't exactly advocate it. He seems to recognize that what he is proposing for Donald Trump would be politically very difficult. So difficult, in fact, that it perhaps cannot be done. But he suggests that the way to extricate the United States from this geopolitical catastrophe is indeed to begin a ground war against Iran. And, well, that is Robert Kagan. You would expect him to be talking in that way. But I'm becoming very concerned that others now, others who I would expect to take a different view, are now also doing so. Wolfgang Munchau in Unheard, who is, to be clear, not a neocon, he's now saying the same thing. He says that the situation that the United States is in at the present time is checkmate, that the United States has to make a decision. Either it accepts defeat in this war, or it escalates massively. And the way to do the escalation is to begin some enormous ground operation against Iran. Both Kagan and Munchau strangely assumed that such an operation would be successful. It's one of the paradoxes of neocons that they never really address the question of capabilities. Munchau acknowledges that he's not a military expert, but he still seems to have this belief that the United States has unlimited military resources, that his military is so much more powerful than Iran's, that if it undertakes a ground operation against Iran, that despite all of the difficulties, it must prevail, simply because it is the United States. I do not share that confidence. I don't think those who are aware of the military situation, the military side. Daniel Davis, Douglas MacGregor, Jim Webb, Joe Kent think that at all. But the fact that two such different commentators as Munchau and Kagan are now again talking about the possibility of a ground war makes me wonder whether this idea isn't circulating out there and isn't being discussed again. And I say this because the President of the United States, Donald Trump, has announced that the latest Iranian proposal to end the crisis, which is a 30-day ceasefire, a moratorium for a certain amount of time on enrichment, plans to hand over some of Iran's enriched uranium to a third party, probably not the United States, and to dilute the rest, and for the release to Iran, the payment to Iran, of all frozen Iranian assets within those 30 days, leading afterwards, as part of the settlement, to a removal of sanctions. Well, President Trump has announced these proposals, which I have to say seem to me reasonable enough, and certainly proposals which could serve as the basis for talks. Anyway, the president has announced that these proposals, these Iranian proposals, are totally unacceptable. And he said this, perhaps not coincidentally, directly after the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, has also come out and said that the conflict with Iran is not yet over. So, if this proposal, this Iranian proposal, is totally unacceptable, what is it exactly that the United States and Israel are planning to do? Well, there have been skirmishes in the Strait of Hormuz, but they have not led to a proper reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. They cannot do so. In fact, commercial traffic has dwindled to a stop. The United States continues to blockade Iran. It's now attacking empty tankers, which will no doubt tighten the blockade to the extent that that blockade passes through the Strait of Hormuz. But I've already said that I believe that Iran has the means to withstand that blockade, the internal means. And besides, we now get more reports about how Iran trade through the Caspian Sea is intensifying, with imports coming increasingly from China, from Russia rather, and also how imports are reaching Iran from China via the land routes with Pakistan. So a complete blockade of Iran is impossible. Airstrikes, well, of course they can happen, but then that would only deplete American arsenals further still. So I wonder whether the pendulum isn't once again shifting back towards the idea of some kind of ground operation, given that, again, the option of negotiations is being ruled out. And, well, on this issue, there's been something that has happened, which is also, in its way, very interesting, because an important Saudi official Prince Turki Al Faisal, who is a grandson of the founder of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz Ibn Saud, and who is chairman of the King Faisal Foundation Center for Research and Islamic Studies. Anyway, Prince Turki has now published an article in which he appears to imply that the blame for the entire conflict ultimately rests with Israel, that there is no value for Saudi Arabia in an outright war with Iran. He says, and this is a direct quote, "Had the Israeli plans to ignite war between us and Iran succeeded, the region would have been plunged into ruin and destruction. Thousands of our sons and daughters could have been lost in a battle in which we have no stake. Israel would have succeeded in imposing its will on the region and remained the only actor in our surroundings. Had the kingdom, that's to say Saudi Arabia, wanted, and it is capable of doing so, to respond to Iran's attacks by destroying Iranian facilities and interests, the outcome would have been the complete destruction of our oil facilities and desalination plants alongside the entire Arabian Gulf coast and even deep inside the region." So here we have Prince Turki saying that for Saudi Arabia, outright war with Iran would be a disaster. And the implication seems to be that the best option for Saudi Arabia and perhaps the other Arab states, Oman, Kuwait, Qatar, is some kind of arrangement with Iran. Perhaps this new security architecture that the Russians and the Chinese have been talking about. And I am going to suggest that all this sudden talk in Washington about how totally unacceptable the Iranian proposals are, this sudden talk of war, this discussion of ground operations, that one of the factors that might be driving it is precisely fear that unless something is done fast, we are going to see over the next few weeks a movement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, brokered by China and Russia, for some sort of regional peace. It was interesting that a day ago, Araghchi had a telephone conversation with the Saudi foreign minister, as well as with the foreign minister of Egypt. So, with everything else going on, the possibility of a return to war in the Persian Gulf could be increasing. Well, that's my program for today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.